Thank you very much. Special music. We appreciate that. That's a very pretty song and very encouraging words. You know, we all are very blessed to have those facts from that song in our life and to count on that. Talk about facts. You know, you think about facts. You know, the Bible is chock full of facts, all kinds of facts. And I'm not telling you anything you already know. But it's also chock full of stories. All kinds of stories. Again, I'm not telling you anything you already know. But all those stories in the Bible, almost all of them, now not every one of them, but almost all of them have something in common. And they have more than one thing, obviously. But what you'll probably find in all the stories is either the villain, the victor, or at least the participant of these stories, whatever one they are, somewhere, somehow displays the character of God. And that's usually the lesson that you'll go back to and you'll find in those stories. It was interesting because I think it was yesterday, before yesterday, I don't remember now. But I like to go on Tubi. If you know what Tubi is, that's a Roku channel. I like to go on Tubi and watch documentaries because they have some pretty interesting documentaries. Some of them's faith-based. Some of them's just history-based or historical. But anyway, there was one play, and I do not remember the name of it because I lost interest very, very fast. The guy was talking about Noah's Ark. And I thought, well, this ought to be interesting. And then he was reported to be a scholar and a theologian on the study of Noah's Ark. And in talking about that, he said, now Noah's Ark, you know, it's in the Bible, and this, that, and that, this happened, and it takes a miracle for this, and to get all the animals to come to Noah, not Noah go after the animals, and for Noah to have instruction to build the ark, and he just listed all this, not to mention how the flood, you know, came about, how waters of the deep erupted from the ground, and then they saw rain for the first time, and he said, obviously, now this was a some ranking member on the study of Noah's Ark. He said, obviously, that's not a very true biblical story. And this is how it really happened. And then at that point, you know, click. You know, so I'm not interested in hearing that because all that's true. All that's fact. You find that's, of course, you have to believe the Bible. Now, if you don't believe the Bible, then it doesn't really matter. But I do like stories, and there's a story that I was reading that I'm going to actually talk about today that I find it very interesting. And it's the story of when I first thought about it, it was a story of a man, one man. But then it got to be a story of not just a man, but two men, and then three men, and then a girl. Actually, there's a lot to this story. And if you don't know who I'm talking about the story of Naaman. Now, maybe it's been a while since you've read the story of Naaman or talked about it. So that's where we're going to go today and talk about his story because, like Mr. Sipes, I have 4 points as well. And 4 points, and I call them strange points because if this same guy who was talking about Noah's Ark would read 2 Kings 5, he would probably say, there's no way that can happen. It's not real. Well, in fact, it takes a miracle. And maybe he didn't believe miracles, I don't know. But anyway, this story is full of, I call it kind of strange or interesting, maybe interesting is a better word, interesting incidents that one might be tempted to think it's a fictional story rather than true history. So that's why I want to share this with you because the 4 points that I picked, I think they're really interesting, they're fascinating, and they're things that we can learn from those 4 points. But to start it off, I'm not going to go to 2 Kings 5 first. I'm going to go to Luke chapter 4. If you are at 2 Kings, hold your place there. Put a marker there because we'll be in and out of that a couple times. But look at Luke chapter 4 because Christ verifies this story that we're going to talk about in a simple statement. Luke chapter 4, verse 27. This is Christ talking. He was inspiring this to be written for us to read. Luke 4 verse 27 says, "And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet. Yet," and this is interesting, "not one of them was cleansed, only Naaman the Syrian." Interesting. Well, that to me, that proves the whole story. And we'll go back and look at the story. But think about the great detective Sherlock Holmes. And let me give you a quote from Sherlock Holmes. He said this: "Eliminate the obvious, and whatever remains, however improbable, must be the answer." Well, that's pretty true. Pretty true. So, you see here, when Naaman experienced the hand of God directly in his life, and he did, because we're going to see that, it changed him forever. So let's go ahead and start the story. Let's go to 2 Kings chapter 5. It's right after 1 Kings. I knew you knew that. 2 Kings 5. What I'm going to read is 1 through 19, but not all at once. But that's where the story kind of generalizes and takes place. But 2 Kings 5, verse 1, we see our first point. And this is, God gave Naaman success. Now the story opens here with kind of somewhat of a curious statement. Like I said, I find this whole story fascinating. Look at verse 1 here. "Now Naaman, commander," now think about who he is here, "commander of the army of the king of Syria," so he is the man, he's in charge, he's the general, "was a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria." That's kind of strange right there. "He was also a mighty man of valor, but a leper." So think, okay, it's set up now. Think about what's going on here. Let's clarify some of this. Who is Naaman? Well, Naaman was a Syrian military man who was very successful. He had servants and he had slaves. He was a commander-in-chief to the king's army, the king of Aram. That's pretty impressive. You think about that right there, who he was. Now, he was not one of God's people, Israel, yet. But we read in verse 1 that through him, God had given victory to the army. So look again at 2 Kings 5 verse 1. Because it says, "Because of him," because of Naaman, "the Lord had given deliverance to Syria." I mean, you and I, if we just take that and don't read anything else or don't go anywhere else, we're going to think, well, that's kind of odd. You know, God gave victory to our enemy. This verse teaches that God is sovereign over all nations, not just religious nations. So that's not really part of the lesson, but that's there's a tidbit of a lesson we can take. It reminded the Jews that they did not own God. Have you ever felt that way? And I'm not asking for a show of hands. But think about this. Now, you know, and I'm guilty of this probably as much as most anybody in here. Maybe everybody. But back in old worldwide, when we started in church, and it was, we were commanded to do this, do this, do this. You don't do this, you don't do this. And we did it. And that's good. We did it. We obeyed. Didn't we take ownership in that? Didn't we take so much ownership that we said, and I think this is a wrong statement, but we said we were the only church of God. There's no other church out there that are God's people. We said that. Back in the beginning, we said that. That is saying that we own God. God's grace is His to give, even to the people that you and I might consider our enemies. What's he say? He says, love your enemies. Do good to them who hate you. So why did God bless the Arameans here and not Israel? Well, you go back and do some more history, and I'm not going to put that in this message, but I recommend you do that. But the Jews here at the time, they were living in a time of general apostasy. They weren't being very godly. That's to put it mildly. They were not acting as God's special called out people. If you go back and look at the history of the Israelites, some years they were up, they were living a godly life, and some years they went down to the bottom. They were doing Satan's work. And then they were back again, then they were down. They were up and down so many times. Well, this is one of their down times. They were down. They mixed worshiping of false gods, which is an absolute no-no, with worshiping the one true God. You know, God says, I'm a jealous God. He's not going to have this. He will not put up with this. You can't have both. We are called to worship and honor God and make a choice to be committed to God and stay committed to God. They were having a problem with commitment. So in Christ's time, the Israelites were the church of the day. They went regularly to synagogues or to temples in Jerusalem. They did this to worship God. And they thought that they were alone. They were loved and cared for by God. And because of this, they became arrogant. What about us? Did that happen to us in the past? Well, I think it did. Has it happened to us now? I hope it hasn't. I hope we've opened our eyes enough to see that, yeah, we are God's people. But we're not the only one of God's people. God's people are in other places. And that's a sermon for another time. But we are God's people. So, what can we learn from this lesson here? Well, I think this lesson here is pretty straightforward. If we don't walk with God 100% committed 100% of the time, we cannot expect God's blessings. It's being hypocritical. Now, it's not earning salvation. It's a gift from God. God says, you know, this is the way, this is what I want you to do, because the end result of this is the kingdom of God, and I want you to be there. But if you're not going to do this, then I'm not going to bless you. The fact is, God may even bring judgment on his people if they stop walking with him. And he will. God is not just interested in churchgoers. An individual's conversion, brethren, has to be much, much deeper than just going to church to get an A in attendance. That means nothing. If our heart, our commitment, our conviction is not in it, then why are we here? We're wasting our time and we're wasting God's time. God wants committed people to be with him. In Naaman's day, there were many Israelites with leprosy. And in the time of Elisha, that's what we're talking about here. Yet none of them was cleansed. Only Naaman, the Syrian. Again, that's just odd. I mean, from our human perspective, that seems odd. Once again, verified what we, you know, by what we read in Luke chapter 4, verse 27. At times, brethren, we may feel that we don't deserve God's mercy. But the truth is that through Naaman, I hope that we see that God will show his love and his mercy on anyone that God wishes. And I'm just very, very happy that it's not up to us, or me even. It is up to God. Point number two. Number two is the witness of the little girl. This is where the second individual comes into play here. Hopefully you're still in 2 Kings. This is 2 Kings 5, 2 through 6. Now the Syrians had gone out on raids and had brought back captive a young girl from the land of Israel. So that kind of sets up, they kidnapped this girl. They brought her back. She was an Israelite, or at least a Jewish descent. She waited on Naaman's wife. That means she served her. Then she said to her mistress, if only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy. I find that just amazing. This little girl, says a young girl, I don't know how old she was, but just for laughs, let's say she's 12 years old. This little girl, think about that, 12-year-old girl, saying something like this to the woman that she's serving by being in captivity. Verse 4, and Naaman went in and told his master, saying, Thus said the girl who is from the land of Israel. In other words, hey, this little 12-year-old girl, I'm just guessing the age, but this is what she said. And then verse 5, the king of Syria, the king, not just your average guy on the street, the king of Syria said, go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel. So he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. Then he brought the letter to the king of Israel, which said, now be advised, when this letter comes to you, that I have sent Naaman, my servant, to you, that you may heal him of his leprosy. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. You see God's hand in this? Well, you will. Just keep watching. But this is probably one of the weirdest parts of this whole story. First, consider the amount of wealth that he was bringing to the king. Silver. 10 talents of silver, 750 pounds of silver in today's value is $350,000. Okay. Clothing, 10 changes of clothing. This wasn't just, you know, a robe off the street or a shirt in the ditch. This was high-end luxury clothing. And they didn't have that much back then. This was valued at between $50,000 and $100,000. But this is the one that just knocks it out of the park. 600 shekels of gold. Approximately 150 pounds. In today's market, that would be just about $6.2 million. Total value, $6.6 million. That's what he's sending Naaman to take with him. Now, let me ask you a question. Have you ever wondered why Naaman, and then the king, his boss, not only listened to this girl, but they acted on this girl's report? If a 12-year-old girl came up to you off the street and told you to do something like that, would you do it? Here was an insignificant, seemingly insignificant little girl, a slave, dictating to the Aramean state of policy. That's what she was doing. This is the king. You know, she was talking to Naaman, who was commander-in-chief. He was no slouch. But then it went straight to the king. Interestingly, it was a little girl to whom Naaman and his wife listened to. For her, this little girl, there absolutely wasn't anything God could not do. Talk about faith. Do we have that kind of faith? And although there were no precedents here, she really believed that God would heal Naaman. Let me read Luke 4, verse 27 to you one more time, just so it's on your mind. And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet, yet none of them was cleansed. So, none of them was cleansed. Only Naaman the Syrian. And that hasn't happened yet. It's getting close. You know, we as Christians, we must absolutely stand firm in faith. We have to remain faithful no matter what. Notice what Paul said. Just a quick jump over Philippians 4, verse 13. Philippians 4, verse 13. A simple statement that if we would all believe this and follow it, we will do well. Philippians 4, verse 13 says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Do we get that? I can do all things. It doesn't leave nothing out. Through Christ who strengthens me. That means that we have to put our faith and trust in God the Father and Jesus Christ. And then we have to be willing to step out on that faith and do it. It always, again, struck me strange that this powerful general, inevitably the king, would even listen to this little girl. Instead of just maybe, you know, patting her on the head and saying, you know, you silly little child, you know nothing about real life. Well, that's something we might say. Or maybe, you know, yes, dear, I'm quite sure that your prophet can do all this, and then just kind of brushing her off and going about our business. I mean, that's how we would act. But here's the thing. This girl's, her life, obviously it carried a credibility that her circumstances could not hide. Think about where she was. Think about how she got there. She didn't just come for a visit. She was kidnapped and brought in to be a slave, a servant. Did she think about herself? Well, I mean, so far in this story, we've seen nothing to indicate that she thought about herself. She was thinking about others. Even her, you know, would-be enemy. What we have to understand is God uses the humble people. And he uses humble people to lead the very powerful people. That's just one lesson that we should take from this. The world might overlook you and me, but never forget that God has handpicked you and me to be here today. For whatever the details of his plan he has for our individual lives, he's handpicked us. I hope that makes chills go down your back. That is so awesome. God did this for us. I think in this little girl's story, there's many characteristics, but there's at least two characteristics of this girl's life that I think are very, very admirable. The first characteristic about this young girl was that she didn't seem to get bitter about her captivity. If somebody comes and yanks you out of your house, are you going to go willingly? Are you going to fight? Are you going to get mad? What's going to happen? And I'm not saying anything. Just think about what she did. Her attitude. As a young Jewish girl captured and taken away from her family and her friends by the Arameans, if I pronounce that right, on a raid into Israel, she could have thought, the only good one of these guys is a dead one. I want nothing to do with this. Maybe that's what I would have thought. And it would have been fair enough, you know, for her to think that about Naaman especially. Naaman, who had been a successful general against her own people, who had kept her and held her in captivity, and still was. But there is no indication in this story that she felt that way. Quite the contrary. She was concerned enough for Naaman to stick her neck out and offer a solution. A solution that she knew the God that she served could take care of and would take care of. That is some pretty strong faith. You and I might have enough faith to say, yeah, I'm going to go here because I think they can do this. But do we ever say, I'm going to go here because I know God will do this? That's a whole other level of faith. She had it. This is exactly what Paul suggested in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 24. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 24. Says, let no one seek his own, but each one the other's well-being. This is a definition of outgoing, or outgoing concern, or outgoing love for others. This is when our concern has a destination, and the well-being of someone else is that destination. It's the opposite of the mindset that we seek self-exaltation. Outgoing concern is a shift in focus. And I know that we all talk about having outgoing concern for others, But when the rubber hits the road, so to speak, do we really? Do we keep it? Do we have it? It's moving from how does this affect me and what I'm going to do to the point of how can I help them and what can I do for them? Regardless of the circumstances, she was in some pretty poor circumstances. Let's look at Philippians chapter 2 again. Philippians chapter 2, verse 3 and 4. Philippians 2, verse 3 and 4. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. That is what we are called to do. That is outgoing concern. That's the love that God has for us, and it's the love that we should have for each other. The second characteristic about this young girl was that there must have been something about her character that made her appear or be known as trustworthy. Now, this is only a guess. You can read the story and make your own summation of this. But why else would Naaman's wife have listened to this young girl first and then bothered to take it to Naaman, let alone Naaman taking it to the king, especially since this girl was a captive and a slave now? I can only think that this girl's character shone out while she was in the captivity of Naaman's household. There had to be something. You know, God was shining through her, and they saw it. Regardless of what the real thing was there, there was something, some kind of evidence that they saw, that they trusted, that they believed in, that they listened to her. When she brought this to Naaman, which, you know, he was in poor shape. He was probably grasping at straws, so maybe anything sounded good. But to have a little girl come up and say, hey, listen, if you go to see this prophet over here, you'll be healed. That's totally in keeping with what we as children of God are called to be. We are to show this kind of an example in our daily life, no matter who we come in contact with, no matter who we end up talking to or being with. And again, we see that Paul exhorts you and I to live a godly life 100% of the time. If you jump over to Romans chapter 1, or I'm sorry, chapter 12, verse 1. Romans 12, verse 1. We're told here, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. If you take all that was said there, look at that very last line, that you may prove. How do we prove something? Usually by our example, by living it. That you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. How do we do that? Well, we have to know it, and then we have to live it. And it seems like this girl was doing just that, no matter how old she was. She was doing that. This young girl's lifestyle caused her to speak up. She spoke up, and by doing so, she played a very significant part in Naaman's healing. And she's in the Bible. She's in the Bible, inspired by God, to show you and I an example of something. She could have looked away, and she could have done nothing. She might have been ridiculed, but she could have been laughed at. Anything could have happened, but she took her courage in her hands and she spoke up for her master's, to her master's wife about a solution. So what can we learn from this? What's the lesson we can learn from this? Well, simply this. Absolutely no one, and I mean no one, is too insignificant that God cannot use him or her if they are willing. She was willing. She did it. Now, we don't know how long she hesitated, if she even hesitated. Maybe she didn't hesitate. Maybe, shortly after she saw what was going on, she did this. But the bottom line was she was willing. She was willing to be a tool in God's hands. And all of us should be willing to be that too. Number three. This is Naaman's response to Elisha. Go back to 2 Kings 5, if you will. This is kind of where the story gets interesting again. This whole story is interesting. The twists and turns, the plot, this will make a good movie. 2 Kings 5, 8, verse 8 through 14. So it was when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, that he sent to the king, saying, "Why have you torn your clothes? Please let him come to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel." So that's kind of interesting. Kind of behind the scenes, they're having this conversation. Elisha's saying, "But don't sweat it. You got to work this out, and there's a plan here." So verse 9, then Naaman went with horses and chariots, and he stood at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha, I love this, Elisha sent a messenger to him. Now, Elisha knew he was coming. We already established that. Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean." Okay, think about this. Elisha knows this guy's coming. Elisha hears a knock, knock, knock on the door. But Elisha didn't answer. Now, I kind of admire that. he knew that there was a bigger thing here going on. He didn't answer. So he just let Naaman be how he was going to be. Verse 14, we see how he was going to be. Naaman became furious, and he went away, and he said, "Indeed, I said to myself, he will surely come out to me." He knew he was going to come out. I'm Naaman, buddy. I'm knocking on your door. You're going to answer. "He will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord, his God." Notice that. He didn't say my God. He said his God. "And wave his hand over the place and heal the leprosy." This is what Naaman's saying. I know what's going to happen. I've done paid all this $6.6 million. I know what's going to happen. Verse 12, this is Naaman again. "Are not the Abana and the Pharpar, the rivers in Damascus, better than all the waters in Israel?" That's kind of abrasive. "So could I not wash in them and be clean?" So he turned and went away in rage. Now, can't you just visualize this? This man with leprosy, in bad, bad shape, thinking, "I want it my way. I paid for it. I want it my way. I don't want it your God's way. I want it my way." So he didn't really appreciate what Elisha said and his instruction. This guy won't even give me the courtesy of answering the door. I can see where this guy might have been a little ticked. But reality is about to set in. Look at verse 13. "And his servant came near and spoke to him." I'm glad somebody here is being level-headed. "And he spoke to him and said, 'My father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you not have done it?'" So it gives him something to think about. "How much more then when he says to you, 'Wash and be clean'?" So after being talked off the ledge of self-reliance, that's where he was at, he listened to his servant. And lo and behold, he followed the advice of Elisha. Verse 14, "So he went down and he dipped 7 times in the Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child. And he was clean." Faith. Could you say Naaman had faith? Or what really happened? Well, his servant called him out and said, "Listen, buddy, you know, you've been dealing with this for how long now? It's not getting any better." And this prophet, and they knew who prophets and what prophets were. They knew what a prophet meant. He's told you to do something. Any other time, you would do what a prophet tells you because you know it's the right thing to do. So why wouldn't you do this? He wanted to go in his rivers in Damascus, and he didn't want to get in that old dirty Jordan. It'd be like somebody telling you to go jump in a high river. Don't really want to, but so he went back to the prophet and he said, this is Naaman. He was kind of a changed man. I think it really took. He went back to the prophet and he said, now I know that there is no God in all the world except the God of Israel. Well, that's pretty impressive. This is what Naaman came to realize. He is so grateful that he offered the prophet even more gifts. But the prophet refused to take it. Verse 16 says, as surely as the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will not accept. Naaman then asked in verse 17 to take 2 mule loads of earth, dirt, so that he could offer sacrifices to the God of Israel and none other. He wants to start a new life, serving God. That's amazing. That's amazing. It took something this dramatic to get to this individual to realize that God is God. And He's the only God. And He can do anything. And Naaman experienced this firsthand. Not everybody does. You know, God calls people how He wants to call people, in the way that He wants to, when He wants to. But it seems like this here was a pretty brilliant calling for this guy. What can we learn here? Well, what we see here is that God requires all of us to do one thing. Exactly. Not roughly, but exactly what He says. He says, go to church on the Sabbath. Not once a month, not once a year. Every Sabbath. Don't eat unclean foods. Not just when you're having a feast, but always. Don't not tithe. Don't not clean for unleavened bread. You know, He wants us to do things exactly as He says. You know what that means? That means He wants us to be obedient. But here's the other thing. If we won't be obedient now, will we be obedient in the kingdom? Well, we won't be, because if we won't be obedient now, we won't be there. So it's that simple. It requires a change in attitude. We saw a change in Naaman's attitude. You know Naaman, you got to admire him. He held out, you know, he held out that Syrian attitude right to the very end, just as long as he possibly could. But then he realized, you know, I don't know what his servant actually had to do to him to make him realize this, but he got it through to him that you need to follow what the prophet of the man of God is saying. And you do this. You know, we refer to him as arrogant, verses 9 through 12. Then, however, his problem had no other cure, and so he swallowed his pride, and that's the big thing right there. He swallowed his pride, and he tried God's way in verse 13 and 14. And once he was healed, he became very thankful, and then he decided to change his life, verse 15 through 19. Naaman determined never to sacrifice to false gods again. And this is a challenge to all of us. When we are deciding and have decided to follow God and follow God's way, it's at that point that we have to make the change. Now, it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take time. But as long as we're making that change, making progress, we'll be just fine. But we can't go back. Notice Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 8 through 10. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not of works, lest anyone should boast. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. Do you think that Naaman would have gone down to the river of Damascus or the rivers of Damascus and would have learned anything? Do you think, and if, say he went down there and he was healed. Now he was told to go to the Jordan. But what if he went down to the rivers of Damascus because he decided to, and God still said, well, he's pretty well doing what's right. Let's go ahead and heal him. You think he would have boasted? He would say, look at me, you know, the man of God told me to do this, but I don't really want to do all this. I'm going to do most of it, but I'm going to do here because this is what I want to do. And I still got healed. I think he would have boasted. God says no. 100% obedience is what's required. When we learn something, we are obligated to follow it. You see, when Naaman experienced the hand of God on him, it absolutely changed him. And that is a great thing. This leads us to point number four, the final incident here. And this is Naaman's request. And I again, when I first read this, I thought, well, even this is kind of a strange request. Verse 18, 2 Kings 5. Verse 18 and 19. Yet in this thing, may the Lord pardon your servant. When my master goes into the temple, he's talking about the king. When my master goes into the temple of Rimmon to worship there, and he leans on my hand, and I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, you know, you're starting to think, oh, has he backslid? What's going on here? When I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Lord please pardon your servant in this thing. Interesting request here. It gets even more interesting. Look what Elisha said to him in verse 19. Then he said to him, go in peace. So he departed from him a short distance. You know, Naaman's request here for an exemption, if you will, to his commitment to only serve the God of Israel, at first it seems a little puzzling, seems a little strange. It's kind of what he seemed like he's asking here. But I think when we see here, he had to go into the house of Rimmon. It was for occasion of the state. His request implied that his heart was not worshiping a false god, but he was not ready yet to give up his position. Now, we could argue that. Is that weak? Is that weak faith? Oh, maybe. Let me ask you this. We're all non-denominational children of God. We believe what United Church of God teaches. We work hard to do everything we can. Has anybody here ever went to a wedding in a Catholic building? Yeah. Were we going there to worship as the Catholics do? Were we going there to honor the individual that we're going there with? Kind of the same idea here. In other words, his motivation was to honor his king. It seems like his king relied on him. He kind of honored him at this point. Now, I don't know really what's going to happen after this. You know, there's more to the story, but we're not going there. But he was here to honor his king. He was not there to follow false gods. Why did Elisha agree? Elisha said, go, you know, go in peace. You know, once we become baptized, and I want us to all think about this. Once we become baptized, we become converted, we are not changed to perfection overnight. I think we will all agree to that. And if If anybody's perfect, I would love to talk to you. I want to know how you've done it. But without question, it takes a lifetime for God to, not that God couldn't do it faster than this, but for God to change us into perfection. As I said many times, you know, we live in this life as physical human beings. We're here to learn, to grow, to become more perfect in God's way. But it's not going to happen until, you know, Christ returns and we're resurrected. You know, because human nature is infallible. It will sin. It will have problems. Without question, it's going to take us our lifetime. And I think that this would have been maybe too much for Naaman to bear as a brand new convert. What would he have done? I don't know. I don't know. It's just, you know, this is just me looking in on this. I mean, what would happen to us the first time we came to Sabbath services? And this did happen back in worldwide. They would say, you quit drinking, you quit smoking, you don't do Christmas, you don't do Halloween today, or you can never come back. I mean, that's how it was. Was that too much? I don't know. I don't know. But we are supposed to be a little compassionate, not tolerant of sin, but compassionate. It looks like Elisha here understood and he was being a little compassionate. Again, I don't know. I don't have all the answers on this. But this is what it seems like. This is a great lesson for us to remember, though, that when we are called, we have been called to clear the path for others, not create stumbling blocks for others. We have to deal in compassion and love. We must be very careful to offer this same patient grace to others that God has given all of us freely. So by guarding the hearts of the young believers, brethren, we will ensure that we never weigh them down with expectations that they aren't ready to make. And that's tough. That's hard. But our goal is to see them soar. Again, not stumble. So let's bring all this together. Let's start wrapping all this up. You know, the story here of Naaman, it serves as a very profound reminder that God's grace is not only issued as a private club or a private club member. It's not only reserved for what we might call the religious insiders, someone like us who think we have the inside track. Instead, it is a force that God has that reaches across many, many borders and seemingly the most unlikely hearts. And that's probably why we're not in charge of it, because there's probably people that God has picked that we wouldn't pick. You know, that's shame on us. By examining these incidents here that we looked at, from an unconverted general receiving divine healing to a what seems like a very insignificant little slave girl whose credible character absolutely moved an empire, we see the true influence is born of spiritual integrity rather than worldly rank. Spiritual integrity is the key. Naaman's journey here teaches us that while we cannot by favor, or by God's favor, with the king's ransom, he tried, we can experience his healing the very moment that we give up our pride and we dip into the humble path of obedience. That's what we should be doing. Ultimately, brethren, as we set the example for others, we should mirror Elisha's patience, Elisha's grace, serving as, again, a path clear who gives new Christians room to develop. And again, we don't tolerate sin or allow sin, but we give them room to understand when they're sinning and it's time to change. It takes time. Our actions must always direct attention away from ourselves and towards the only heroes, if you will, capable of transforming lives permanently. And of course, we know that is God the Father and Jesus Christ.